Hi, this is Paul Gio, and you're listening to the School of Hollywood.
Hi, I'm Steve Owens on School of Hollywood, and it's exciting to have Paul in the house. He is a major player in the city, having been a producer on NCIS New Orleans, Leverage, and so many other shows. And he's going to give an insight on Hollywood from writing to acting. But before we get started, I'd like you to like the podcast, and if you can rate it, that'd even be better, and tell your friends about it. Let's get started now. Hi, it's Steve Owens, and today on School of Hollywood is Paul Gio, a producer who's done a lot of TV shows. But we have an interesting history, and we didn't even know until today, or at least I didn't. I was in the movie Lesson Zero as James Spader's double and stand-in, and Paul was his in Supernova.
What? Oh my gosh, you buried the lead. How have we been knowing each other this long, and you're just now dropping this on me?
I didn't realize until I start going through your bio today on IMDb. I'm like, wow, a small world.
Wow. Yeah, I was in a room today literally telling people that stand-in is like the best-kept secret in Hollywood for an entry-level job into the business.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you get an opportunity to, you know, have the director say, turn this way, do this, do that, watch who's stealing the scenes. And the whole thing, whereas the extras are sitting back in the other room talking and jabbing away and not paying attention, which they should be, because it's a free acting class, yeah. The whole thing. Yeah. But what was interesting on Lesson Zero, I actually have more screen time than Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt was an extra in Lesson Zero.
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. I've got to go back and watch it now. I just watched it actually last month. I'm going to have to check it again now.
Let's put it this way. Mainly you see the back of my head, so because I was doing the doubling as well.
You did the best back of someone's head that Hollywood ever seen.
So, you know, that was one of my breaks in Hollywood into the movie. Actually, it was my first movie that I actually worked in. And you actually did quite a bit of the stand-in, and before you made your big transition into writing.
I had a whole career as a stand-in, yeah. I started standing in when I was still in college, and I did it for several years before I got my writing break.
And your first writing break, was that Judging Amy?
No. I did. Felicity was my first staff job. And the very first thing I was ever paid to write was a freelance episode of a show called Snoops. That was a David E. Kelly show starring Gina Gershon and Paula Marshall.
Oh, wow. David Kelly was one of the greatest showrunners out there.
Yeah, they pulled the plug after 13 on that one. But what was funny, so I got hired to write a freelance, and I wrote it. And the showrunner, because David didn't run his own shows, you know, he just sat up in his tower and rewrote everyone. He called me in and said, hey, I've got good news. David only rewrote like 90% of your episode. And I thought he was being facetious, you know. I was like, oh my gosh. And it's my very first gig, and I thought, wow, what a failure. And he goes, no, I'm serious, that's like a compliment. Usually we are all rewritten 100%. He said 10% of your script David liked. It's like, wow. And so they offered me a staff position in the back nine, and then it got canceled. And then it was from that, within the same couple of weeks, actually, that I got the offer to go do Felicity for JJ.
Oh, that is awesome. And that was a great show as well.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, she cut her hair, but.
Yep. And I was there. That was the season I was there.
And then you went to Judging Amy.
No. Then I went to, do you remember the UPN network? That's how far back we're going. I went on to a show called Level 9, which was about cyber cops chasing cyber criminals through cyberspace. It was literally about 10 years ahead of its time, and it was another 13 and out. And then I went to Judging Amy.
Well, on Judging Amy, you're an executive story editor, and then the next season you're a co-producer. What does an executive story editor do? Because isn't that kind of like what the showrunner does?
No, it's the titles in writing are all mandated by the WGA, and they're basically just money levels there. So you're a staff writer, which is the bottom level, and you're on a weekly, usually a 20-week contract. And then the next level up from that is story editor. And you're just sort of one step up, literally, from a staff writer. A staff writer is not guaranteed a script. A story editor may be guaranteed a script during that season. And you make more money. And then your third year, technically, you're an executive story editor. And there's another bump in pay. But you're not, until you hit the producer level, which is co-producers, the bottom one, that's when you start being paid per episode or all episodes produced. When you're a story editor and below, you're on a weekly.
Paul, did the WGA lockout with agents hurt your business?
No. And it actually has turned out to be a really positive thing for the Guild. The Guild was, we were very much, I mean, the decision to do that was voted on and it was an overwhelming majority, but there was still the minority that voted against it was very vocal. And a lot of writers were terrified and thought this is the end of, you know, civilization for screenwriters. And what it did is it proved something that I've been preaching for years, that the agent is really overrated in our business. That you know, I spoke at the St. Louis Film Festival a couple of years, and I had this whole chart. I had done this research of all the screenwriters that I know personally that are my friends, all the screenwriters that I listed who I have met who are an acquaintance, and then all the screenwriters that I had heard in interviews or speak or knew their stories, their, you know, origin stories, so to speak. And I came up with a list of 320 different writers. And of those 320, three of them got their start because of an agent. And so once we did this thing where we, you know, technically fired all our agents, it showed how much that the work a lot of times doesn't come because of the agent. You know, they're very important as far as negotiating deals and doing all that, especially if you don't have an attorney. But especially in television, the vast majority of employment is done from, you know, an executive producer who's a writer hires another writer. And yes, agents pitch you to studio and network execs and they send your scripts in, but the people who do the actual hiring are the other writers. And it was very eye-opening for a lot of the Guild. And after a lot of screaming and shouting and foot stomping, within the first 6-8 weeks, it really became apparent how communal we are and how everyone was coming together. I was still on Twitter back then, and there was a hashtag created called WGA Staffing Boost, where all of us sort of veteran writers, upper level writers, were all coming together on Twitter, and we were agreeing to read and promote non-guild writers or staff level writers. And there was this huge thing, myself and Javi Grillo Markswatch and a couple other, Jeff Lieber, some upper level writers like myself, were all reading scripts from people and sharing publicly, you know, hey, this person's really great, you got to check them out. We were telling our other showrunner friends about them, and it was a super positive thing. So then by the time, you know, Verb was the first agency to jump on board and sign the agreement, you know, basically agreeing not to, you know, create, you know, do antitrust, break antitrust laws, and all the other agencies started to jump on board. And, you know, the big ones held out, CAA and WME held out till the very end, but they have now realized that, you know, the Guild is strong. We're a very strong union and we come together. And so now everybody's back on board, you know, and Endeavor Content, I think, is their producing entity. And so they had to formally make that a completely separate thing from the agency and whatever CAA calls their producing entity now. So it ended up being a really great thing. And it really opened everyone's eyes that, you know, it's getting work is really about relationships more than a rep promoting.
I noticed that you've worked with, obviously you've done two TV shows and a feature film with Dean Devlin. How did you guys connect?
So Dean, I was hired by John Rogers, who created Leverage, to write on Leverage. And Leverage was, at the time, it was the only independently produced television show on TV, not counting reality stuff. Dean was his own studio. So Electric Entertainment, which is Dean's company, produced that show, and then they licensed it to TNT. So that's where we connected. And then he also did Librarians, which I went on to after Leverage.
And didn't you do a film with him as well too?
Yeah, it was, we did Geostorm. It was actually at the end of Leverage. He called me up in his office one day. It's kind of funny. And, you know, he was the big boss. He was the studio head. So I didn't have nearly as much interaction with him as I did like John Rogers and the other writers. And this, I was sitting with Rogers just hanging out. We were at the end of the season and the assistant said, Paul, Dean wants to see you up in his office. And I was like, uh-oh, okay. And I go up there and, you know, he's like, hey buddy, what's going on? And I'm like, hi. And he goes, listen, I got an idea for a movie I want to pitch you. I want you to tell me what you think. And so he pitches me a concept, which is satellites control the weather and then they're weaponized. And he pitches me one scene and he's like, what do you think? And because he was my boss, I was like, that's a great idea, Dean. You should, you know, yeah, I love it. And he goes, great. I want you to write it with me. And I was like, wow, okay. And he's like, yeah, it's going to be fantastic, man. And so I go back downstairs and I go to John Rogers and he's like, what was that about? And I go, he pitched me a movie he wants me to write with him. And John smiles and goes, is it the satellite movie? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, yeah, he pitched that to me about a week ago. And so then that led to Geostorm years later. Like,
Dean was actually a great mentor for me in the 90s. I could call him and then ask him questions, and he was very open and giving me answers.
Yeah, there was in the mid-90s, he was about the biggest producer in Hollywood. He was the man.
Leverage is one of my favorite TV shows that Dean did, and you were one of the producers on it. What made you want to write on that show?
You know, that's a great question. I had not seen Leverage, and this is nothing going back to reps and agents. I had never seen Leverage, and it was going into, I think it's third season maybe, and I had heard about it, but I didn't know what the show was. I don't think it was marketed very well in the beginning. I had no idea what the show was about. I just knew Timothy Hutton was doing television on, you know, basic cable. And so one night they had, for whatever reason, they were doing like a little mini marathon. There was like four or five episodes on one night, and I watched them and I just fell in love with it. I mean, I'm a huge fan of heist films and all that. And Hutton was great, and Aldous Hodge, and you know, Beth Riesgraf. And it was, I just loved it. And I called my agents and I was like, hey, this show just got picked up for another season. I want to write on the show. And my agents at the time were like, oh, there's no openings on it. And I was like, oh, that's too bad. Okay, well, it makes sense, because why would anyone want to leave that show, right? So I kind of forgot about it. And then about a month or two after, I got myself a manager which I had never had before. And the first thing my manager did is sit down and said, okay, let's talk about you. What do you want? What's your dream job? What do you want to do right now in your career? And I said, well, like, there's a show I just discovered, Leverage, on TNT that I'd love to write for, but I heard there's no openings, you know? And my manager's like, well, you know, I know John Rogers, I'll give him a call. Turns out my agent never bothered calling. I don't know what the reason was, whether they were lazy, whether they had something else going on, another client, but he called up John Rogers, and Rogers was like, oh my God, we're looking for a supervising producer, like a mid to upper level writer. We're desperate. And so my brand new manager sent my material over. John Reddick called me in the very next day. I met with him and Chris Downey and got the gig. But it was all started because I just watched it and just fell in love with it, you know? And I think it's because, like, I have a love of heist films. And it's also, it was a show that, what I loved about it, it was optimistic. It was positive. You know, it wasn't dark and heavy. Everything, you know, was trying to emulate Breaking Bad at that point. And everybody was going dark and everybody was going edgy. And Leverage was fun. You know, it was just like you sat down and you had fun for an hour. And that's why I loved it. It's, to this day, Steve, it's I consider it the best job I've ever had.
That's really awesome that your manager was able to get that for you. So tell me about the transition from going from being a stand-in to an actor into writing and then becoming the producer. Did everybody just come out of the woodwork saying, hey, can you give me a job?
Well, what's funny is because in my stand-in life, you know how the majority of stand-ins are aspiring actors. I was an aspiring writer. So when I went into the writing world, my friends, if they were having success, they were gone into the acting world. And so yeah, there was some crossover sometime where it's like, hey, is there anything? And I, on like a Judging Amy, especially, I brought some people in for casting, but I didn't have any juice then, any influence to really say, hey, cast my friend. I could just get him in front of the casting director. And then that was out of my hands. But it's been fun. You know, that's like, I enjoy being in a position now to be able to give back. And there's, you know, I have a couple of really good friends, a fantastic actor who's a very close friend of mine, a guy named Malachi Weir, who I don't know if you're familiar with the show Billions. Yeah, so he played Lonnie Watley on Billions with the big salt and pepper fro. Yeah, he's just a gem of a human being. And so, like, I have a guy, I have him, and I have another friend of mine who's an actor that anything I produce from now on, I'm putting them in. Like, everything I write now, I have a character that I'm writing for Malachi, because he's a friend of mine and I want to give back, and, you know, he'd be doing the same for me.
You really are a great dude being able to do that for your friends. So tell me about the difference from working with the independent shows like Dean Devlin's, which he is the main boss, to going to NCIS New Orleans, and you've got the entire CBS Corporation behind you.
It's night and day. Yeah. Not only is broadcast vastly different than basic cable, just by the sheer, you know, it's like I'd compare it to a you know, speedboat compared to an aircraft carrier. But then add to that, like I said, Leverage and Librarians was produced by Dean. He was an independent studio. So, you know, we had one person that we got notes from, and that was Dean. And you go into the corporate machine that is CBS and CBS Studios, and suddenly there are all these other people, some of them you never even see, that have to have their fingerprints on every episode. So, you know, suddenly where I was in a writer's room that was very much driven by creativity and best idea wins and how far can we push it, and we want to do a story about this or a story about this, okay, let's do it, to the corporate structure of CBS and a show that's part of a giant franchise. You know, NCIS is probably the most successful franchise in television history, other than maybe the Law and Order franchise. And they have very specific, I don't want to say hoops you have to jump through, but they have a very specific pattern to follow. And yeah. And so that was, and it was also, it was very much procedural, 100%. And I am a character guy first and foremost, and always have been. And when you look at my resume, it's all character driven. And so I was hoping, and the reason I was hired, one of the reasons was, oh, he can bring some character into this procedural. And, but it was a struggle. The thing that was hardest, most difficult for me was just trying to navigate that corporate structure. And, you know, you turn a beat sheet in and there's notes from four or five people and you have to redo it. And then there's notes from four or five other people. And then the same thing with the outline. And it's like at every juncture, there's even more people putting their fingerprints on it, which it's really not the most efficient way to run, but that's corporate America.
How long does it take to actually write one of those episodes with all everybody's fingerprints on it?
It's that's another thing. It's funny. I can sit here obviously in Monday Morning Quarterback and say, wow, you guys would be so much more efficient if you did this and this, but it's just part of the process. Like that's the show. Like I'm sure all big giant broadcast procedurals, they start out, you know, when the writers get together in June or whenever it is, everything's on time and you're way ahead of the game. You know, you're 6 weeks ahead of the first episode being shot. And probably by mid-season, you're days ahead of the next episode being shot. And it's because of what you're saying. It would take 2 to 3 days to get through the first round of notes, and then another 2 or 3 days for the outline series of notes. So then, you know, instead of like on Leverage Librarians, sometimes we had 3 weeks to write our drafts, which is a lot of time in episodic television. On NCIS New Orleans, you'd get 2 weeks if you were lucky. And then once you turn that draft in, there'd be a first round of notes with the studio and the showrunner, and you'd usually get your shot at that rewrite. And then after that, it was just taken away from you for no other reason than speed. You know, the showrunners would just take it, and or the you know, the number two, sometimes I would do work like that, but they would just take it and get it done because we're only days ahead of production at that point. It's really an antiquated system.
What's the difference between the supervising producer and the showrunner?
The supervising producer is sort of an in-between level between what's considered a mid-level writer, which is a producer, co-producer, and an upper-level writer, which is co-EP and EP. And I consider supervising producers more on the upper level because I know to attain that credit, you have to have put in a certain number of years. So you have a certain amount of experience or you're not going to have that credit. And it all depends. Every show's different, and it's how the showrunner wants to work. A lot of times it's very communal and all the positions are kind of the same. And sometimes, especially on the bigger broadcast shows, it's very hierarchical. And, you know, the supervising producer has certain responsibilities. Like they may oversee a script that's being written by a staff writer or story editor. And just kind of literally supervise them and getting that draft in and dealing with casting and being in the editing room. And then other responsibilities that they probably don't have that the co-EPs like myself and the EPs do is running the room when the showrunner's absent, you know, and keeping the writer's room going and functioning and sort of overseeing problems. If there's a problem on set and the showrunner's unavailable, the co-EP is the one who puts that fire out. So the supervising producer is kind of just below that, but above the other, you know, positions.
How often is somebody who is a non-writer fall into the role of showrunner or supervising producer?
It's very rare that they're a showrunner. It's certainly been done a few times, and in my opinion, with not much success. Because if you're not a writer, it's really tough to run a show. But there's a lot of non-writing executive producers in television, and the ones that I've worked with and know of, they generally focus on the directing and editing side of the show, whereas the show running EP will handle the writer's room and all the scripts and all the writing. The non-writing executive producer will be in charge of hiring the directors and keeping the look of the show the same and overseeing all the editors in post. That's mostly what they do.
Fabulous. What advice would you give a up-and-coming writer?
Oh, wow. It's, you know, we could do a whole 3-hour podcast just on that. So my best advice is trust your voice, your own voice. Like a lot of younger writers get wrapped up into these how-to screenwriting books and these formulas for structure and, you know, the inciting incident on this page and that. And in my opinion, all that produces are scripts that sound exactly like everyone else who's reading those same books and living by those same rules. I say the best thing a writer can do is trust their own unique voice. You know, if I get a script in that's, you know, the structure's off or it's improperly formatted and stuff, that doesn't bother me because I can teach them that. If it's got an original voice, if it's got dialogue that sings, if it's got characters I haven't seen before, that's gold to me. You know, where I'll take that script 100 times out of 100 over a script that might be technically perfect, but has no life to it, no originality, no what I call voice.
It's interesting that you say that because there was a couple scripts that I received from talent management side, and one of them was emojis throughout the whole script. You know, little smiley faces. Really? I'm like, and the crazy thing is the writer ended up getting a meeting with Paramount. I was like, how in the world is this happening?
Then God bless Paramount, because that shows that they were looking for originality and voice, whereas most people would have looked at that and thrown it in the trash.
What a lesson today in the School of Hollywood on becoming a writer, producer, showrunner. Man, Paul really gave some good insights. And Paul is going to be back for part B of this, and he's going to be talking about what it takes to do to control a room when you're going up for a series regular. I hope you close that show. And don't forget to like the podcast, tell your friends about it, and most of all, follow your dreams. Don't let anybody crush them.